Well, good morning. My name is Ben. I'm the lead pastor here at CORE. And like Josh said just a few minutes ago, we are so excited that each and every one of you guys are here with us. And around here, we acknowledge this almost every single week. I mean, if you're joining us online, we consider you to be a part of our family. And we have people every single weekend that watch from all over the world, from Guatemala to South Carolina to Worcester, Ohio, all across our country. If you're here for the very first time, man, what we want you to know is that we could not feel more honored, more privileged that you have chosen to walk into this place. Because around here, we get it. We know just how difficult it is to walk into a church for the very first time or to walk back into a church after you've given up on church a long time ago. And we want you to know that we see you and we're so incredibly excited that you have overcome those nerves and some of that tension to walk into this place. But also, if you find yourself walking in here for the 100th, 200th time, you call CORE home. Man, we know right smack dab in the middle of summer that there are a million things that are vying for your attention. A million things that you could have chosen to do otherwise, and yet you chose to spend an hour of your weekend with us. And so we simply wanted to stop and say thank you, and that we are so glad that you're here as we find ourselves diving into part three of this series that we are in throughout the month of July that we are calling Your Integrity, Our World. And over the course of the next several months, we are really rolling out some incredible opportunities that we have for us individually and collectively to be able to impact our city and our world. Things like Stand for Shelby. Maybe some of y'all were a part of our first Adopt-A-Block of summer 2023 this last Tuesday night. Another one coming up in August. Some of you may have been a part of our global impact trip to Guatemala and some incredible expansion opportunities along those lines that are coming up as well as countless additional community and global impact initiatives for us as a church to really stand for our city and stand for our world. That we're a church that believes the local church should be known more for what it's for than what it's against. But there's a danger in relying on those sorts of things as our only source of impacting our city and our world. You see, it's really easy for me and maybe for you to begin to believe that things like Stand for Shelby and Adopt-A-Block, global impact trips, or community and global impact initiatives that happen right here at CORE Community Church are the sole ways in which we impact our city and in our world. And yet the reason why I say that there's a danger in falling back on that belief that those one-off opportunities are our only chance to impact our city and our world is because we believe this. In fact, it's the entire belief that this series revolves around. That every single one of us, regardless of who we are, what we walked in here with, what our past, our present looks like, that every single one of us have an opportunity to impact and influence our world every single day. And the greatest tool we have at our disposal to be able to make the greatest impact possible on the people around us is our integrity. You see, integrity is the ability to make choices that are the right and noble things just because they're the right and noble things. It's the simple definition that we've given throughout this series. It's the ability to make the right and noble choice regardless of whether it benefits you or costs you. To listen to this ought to that exists inside of every single one of us as humanity, but that didn't originate with us. For us to be able to make the right and noble choices in our lives, even when it gets hard, when the shortcut or the easy route is offered, and yet we choose to do the right things in our relationships because we understand this. Our choices of integrity or lack of integrity don't begin and end with us. That our choices and our decisions ultimately affect the people around us. And that ultimately our choices and our decisions, when left to the side of lacking integrity, always add stress to the people around us. Maybe for some of us, we've experienced that in our own lives and our own stories, but all of us have certainly witnessed that in other people's stories. That when they make choices that lack integrity, it always adds stress to the lives of the people around them, be it their spouse, their kids, their coworkers, their employees, whatever it may be, that the load is always transferred. Just like a beam in a structure. When its structural integrity fails, the weight that has been placed on that beam in that building is ultimately transferred to the rest of the beams around it. And the same is true in all lives and within our relationships. You see, your integrity may be personal, but it's never private. Your integrity may be a personal decision, but the effects of that decision never begin and end with you. Your integrity always affects your relationships, and what we talked about last week was this concept. Your relationships ultimately always affect your impact. And so if your integrity affects your relationships and your relationships affect your impact, then ultimately the equation is your integrity always affects your impact on the world around you. But the question we tackled in our discussion last week was this. Well, within my life, as I look back on my past, and every single one of us, myself included, have found ourselves there. Looking back on the moments of all lives in which integrity has gone by the wayside, and we've lost sight of that driving force, that voice that exists inside of every single one of us that was implanted on our hearts as humanity, as we lose that, how do we get it back? Or how do we get it for the very first time? And we introduce this difficult question, a question that sometimes comes with a little bit of embarrassment, but a question that if asked, and the precursor of every single decision we make can help us begin to allow integrity to guide us, to have that voice in our lives that it was meant to have to drive us to our purpose, to God's plan for our life and for our future. And the question was this: what guides me? When it comes to this particular decision, what guides me? Is it money? Sexual pleasure? Recognition? People-pleasing? Or is the thing that I'm allowing to guide my decisions integrity? And ultimately, a few thousand years ago, one of the wisest guys to ever walk on this earth, a guy by the name of King Solomon, began to paint this word picture in our minds, this word picture of what it looks like when we allow integrity to guide us, but also what it looks like when we allow a lack of integrity. Through avenues of people-pleasing or recognition or money or sexual pleasure to be the thing that guides us. See, in Proverbs chapter 11, verse 3, King Solomon writes this. And picture this in your mind along with me. He says, "The integrity of the upright will guide them, but the crookedness of the treacherous will destroy them." You see, the word picture that Solomon is creating here is a picture of two different types of people. One person stands upright, and an upright person is capable of seeing down the road. They see their decisions not just simply through the me in the here and now, that everything is about me and getting what I want, when I want it, and what affects me immediately. But when you stand upright, you see down the road of your life. People of integrity are capable of standing upright and recognizing that all of my decisions aren't just about me right now. That ultimately my decisions affect other people and they affect my future. But then what does he say? But the crooked, those who find themselves hunched over, can only see the road directly in front of them, can only see what happens next, believe that their life is only about them. And ultimately that kind of outlook, what does King Solomon say? Leads to destruction. Begins to lead our lives and our future in a direction that we never wanted to go. You see, sometimes we have to be able to ask the difficult and oftentimes embarrassing question, in this moment, what is it that guides me? And when we ask that question, to begin then to see integrity as a muscle in our lives. The more we use it, the stronger it gets. And that integrity always takes this snowball effect. And here's what I mean. In the moments of our lives when we make the difficult choice to not take the shortcut or the easy route, but to make the choice of integrity, regardless of if it benefits us or it costs us, in those moments, the next time we're faced with a similar decision, when we choose integrity, it always gets easier to make that choice a second time. And then it steamrolls into doing it a third time and a fourth time. But the inverse is also true. That just like a muscle, when we don't use it, it gets weaker. And when we make choices that lack personal integrity, the next time it's much easier to make a similar choice, and so on and so forth. But today we shift our focus to this second question. You see, in all lives, as we begin to get back integrity and this driving voice that has been implanted on every single one of our hearts as humanity, as we begin to ask this question, what guides me? The next question is just as vital. That now that I've started to get integrity back in my life and began to listen to that voice that has been implanted on my heart, how do I protect my integrity? How do I guard it? Because if we were all being ridiculously honest, what we'd be forced to admit is this, is that in the world in which we live, it is so easy for us to be consumed by something other than integrity. For us to be consumed by the things around us, and ultimately for us to be consumed by something called our appetites. Our appetites for more. Our appetites for better. Our appetites in all lives that we can slowly begin to slip into, allowing to rule us and dominate us and shift its weight over us as we live our lives. You see, for so long, what has happened to many of us is we have forgotten this reality when it comes to the appetites of our lives. This appetite to get more, be more in our lives. That ultimately within our lives, we have a choice to make. We can either rule your appetites or they will rule you. Rule your appetites or they will rule you. And our appetites will rule us if we allow them to, regardless of your beliefs and regardless of your faith. And the reason why I know this and you know this so well is because all too often we have witnessed this in other people's lives and probably within our own lives, we have lived this, that it is capable for us to believe right and still do wrong. That I don't know about your life, but I have faced countless situations in my past in which that has rung true. It is capable for me to believe right and still do wrong. And ultimately, what that brings to the surface is this, is that there is a competition that stirs inside of every single one of us as humanity, a competition between our integrity and our appetite. And within this competition that exists inside of every single one of us, we are left to make a choice every single day. Do I choose my appetite or do I choose my integrity? And oftentimes what that forces us into is this, is if these two things are in competition with one another, our appetite and our integrity are ultimately at war inside of every single one of us in the decisions of our life. It forces us to make this decision. I have to say no to my integrity in order to say yes to my appetites. Or I have to say no to my appetite in order to say yes to my integrity. And sometimes we step back and we wonder, why is it so difficult to just do what we ought to do? Shouldn't it be simple? But it never seems to be simple. And this is why. Because for us as humanity, it's difficult for us to determine and decipher which one we should say no to. Because quite frankly, let's just be honest and real for a second. We're all capable of doing that, right? Is that oftentimes the appetites that we pursue are socially acceptable and reasonable appetites. I mean, there's nothing inherently bad or wrong with pursuing things like recognition, respect, progress, achievement, stuff, more stuff, new stuff. Just a little bit more in our lives. And all those things seem like reasonable things to strive for until those things begin to rule us. And until those things begin to compete with our integrity. And sometimes being capable of stepping back and seeing our appetites, no matter how reasonable and socially acceptable they may seem, seeing our appetites for what they are and what we know about them help us to shift our perspective when it comes to our appetites. See, I believe that there are three primary truths, things that we know about our appetites that will allow us to shift our perspective and our focus when it comes to our appetites. The first truth that we know about our appetite, this is what those of us in the room who consider ourselves to be theists would believe, those of us who believe that there is a God. You see, what we believe about appetites is this, is that God created them. Is that within every single one of us as humanity, God created the ability to work with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, an ability for creativity and progress and achievement within our lives. It was meant to be a good thing, something that would allow us to further the kingdom and make Jesus' name more known within our lives, within our stories, within our legacy. But somewhere along the way, that thing that God created to be good in our lives and our story, sin distorted it. Just as God created it, sin crept into our lives and in our stories. And instead of our appetites being something that we ruled and we controlled, it became something that slowly controlled us. That wielded the power and slipped into the first position in our lives as the most important thing. If I just get to this stage, this amount of money, this amount of recognition with this nameplate on the door, then I'll finally have arrived and we make the driving force of our life that. Accomplishing that, getting that with our lives. God created them to be good, but somewhere along the way, sin distorted them. What we also know about our appetites is that appetites are never fully and finally satisfied. See, when it comes to the appetites of our lives, they are never fully and finally satisfied because our appetites are always a moving finish line. The best example that we have is the appetite of money or finances in our lives. All of us in our past have found this same story playing out again and again and again. That maybe we became an adult and we got married and we were flat out broke. We seemingly had nothing. And we set this desire, this appetite towards it. If our paychecks could just have this many zeros behind it, if we could just be saving this much money, if we could just be making it by making this much money every single month, then we'd be good. We'd be happy. We'd be content. We wouldn't need anything else. And yet what always happens? That by the time we reach that finish line, the finish line has already moved. And we've already created a new picture of contentment and happiness in our lives. I know 5 years ago when we had absolutely nothing, we said X amount is what would make us happy. But by the time we've reached X amount, we need XX amount in our lives in order to be happy. Because our appetites are always fueled by one word, more. I just need a little bit more than the more that I needed before in order to be happy, in order to be content, in order to quench this unquenchable hunger, this appetite that exists inside of me. Our appetites are never fully and finally satisfied. And then lastly, what we know is that our appetites always whisper now, never later. Our appetites always whisper now, never later, because our appetites do not understand the concept of delayed gratification. Am I right? Our appetites only know that I want what I want, and I want it when I want it, and that is right now. And that, y'all, I understand. That, y'all, I have so often gotten swept up into, because I want this church to be a certain size, and I want it to grow in that way right now. I want our financial standing to be a certain way, and I want it right now. I want my kids to grow and be healthy and be smarter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I want it right now. I don't want to be patient to wait for that. I don't want to have to work through it. I want it right now in my life. And you see, calling out those truths about our appetites allow us to approach our appetites and ultimately this competition between our appetites and our integrity in a much healthier manner. Ultimately, those truths begin to expose this other truth in our lives and in our stories. That along the way, we come to recognize that our future is not worth sacrificing for our appetites. The things that are most important to us are not worth sacrificing for the appetites we have right now. And we see that reality taking place throughout humanity for all of time. In fact, about 4,000 years ago, in 1800 BC, we get the account of a family that for some of us, we know of well if we've grown up in church. If you don't know it well, I'm going to give you the snapshot of this family and what's taking place. It's the family of a man named Abraham. And if you know nothing about Abraham, Abraham and his wife, Sarah, found themselves to be barren. They were unable to have children. And yet, in their state of being unable to bear children, and God came and he made this promise to them. One day your descendants will outnumber the stars. And it was like this laughing matter to them. Like, we can't have kids. How are we going to have descendants that outnumber the stars? But then God blessed them and they were able to have kids. And then their kids' kids started to have kids. And the rabbit effect started to take place, right? You know? And it was just multiplication taking place everywhere. And we pick up this story in the life of Abraham's son, Isaac. And Isaac has now had two children, children by the name of Jacob and Esau. And many of us have heard the story of Jacob and Esau, and yet what we don't recognize offhand is that we always say the story of Jacob and Esau. But really, it should be the story of Esau and Jacob. Because Esau was the older brother. He was the one who came first. He was the one who was most important. He was the one who was given a birthright. And this concept of a birthright that was passed on to the firstborn child is something that is somewhat of an unfamiliar concept to us 4,000 years later. But it was something that was special and meaningful and common in ancient Jewish culture. You see, essentially, this is what took place. A birthright was passed on within a family to the child that was born first. Not because of achievement, not because of character, not because of anything they had earned. Just simply because they came out of the womb first, they were blessed with what was called a birthright. And a birthright came with some special attributes to it. One of them being that if you were the firstborn child and received the birthright, you received a double inheritance. What that means is this, is that when your parents passed away, as the firstborn child, you were given double what all of the other children. So if there were two of you, you were given 66% of the inheritance, and your younger sibling was given 33% of the inheritance. If there were nine of you, which was common practice 4,000 years ago in ancient Jewish culture, it meant that you got 20% of the inheritance, and all of your siblings got 10% of the inheritance. Sounds pretty good, right? But there was also something else. There was a whole list of things that came with the birthright, but there was something else that was absolutely incredible in family life 4,000 years ago. And some of y'all who are older siblings or oldest siblings in the room are going to say, bring back the birthright. There was something called judicial authority that was passed on with the birthright. And what that meant was this, is that any disagreement that took place within the family, the oldest child ultimately had judicial authority. Meaning that the oldest child in any argument, disagreement, be it financially, be it whose toy was it, whatever it may be, had the authority to determine judicially who was the winner and who was the loser. Who got it and who got left out. And with the birthright, ultimately what that means, this is where my mind goes, y'all. I don't know if y'all are as broken as me, but it means every argument that I was ever in life within my family, I would win. Because I would have a judicial authority as the oldest child in receiving the birthright. There was some incredible significance and benefit to receiving the birthright. But what we're going to come to find is that Esau, the oldest son, was willing to sacrifice this blessing in his future for an appetite right now. We pick up the story of these two brothers in Genesis chapter 25, the very first book in God's instruction manual for all lives, Genesis chapter 25, starting in verse 27. And as we move through, I'm going to help us understand this better by bringing some clarity as we move through each verse of this sort of eight-verse passage here. And we're going to hunker down here, and we're going to spend our time, and it's going to reveal something incredible for all lives, our stories, and our future as well. Here's how it begins in verse 27. As the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter. He was an outdoorsman. But Jacob had a quiet temperament, preferring to stay at home. Right here in this very first verse, what we see being underlined and underscored is this reality, that these two boys were vastly different from one another. There was competition that took place between the two of them. And if we really picked up this story just a few verses before it, as it outlined the birth of these twins, Jacob and Esau, what we would find is this. Esau was the one who came out. His birthright was granted literally because of minutes between the two of them within the birth. And yet when these two came out, Jacob being the second one born, it tells that he was hanging on to the heel of his brother Esau. Like, get back in here. The birthright is mine. I want to come out first. And from this moment, it was outlined that there would be constant competition that existed between these two brothers. And we see it outlined here from the very first verse, that these two are vastly different from one another. But then we see it accentuated and the unforgivable sin of all parents, at least from the eyes of all kids, that takes place in the next verse. In verse 28, it continues. Isaac loved Esau because he enjoyed eating the wild game Esau brought home. But Rebekah loved Jacob. There was an admittance that these two parents had a favorite child. Isaac, the father, loved his son because he did all the same things that he, Isaac, did. He was an outdoorsman, and he loved the wild game that he brought home from hunting and fishing, etc., etc., etc. He was the one that loved to go out and play catch out in the yard with his father. But Jacob was a mama's boy. He loved being at home with mom, staying by mom's side, learning everything that mom had. And ultimately, you can see their two temperaments begin to sort of mirror their parents in this sentiment. Here, this division and this competition is being accentuated in these first two passages. But then what we see happen next is something absolutely remarkable. In verse 29. One day when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau arrived home from the wilderness, exhausted and hungry. Some translations use the word instead of exhausted, exasperated. And oftentimes with brilliant people like biblical scholars and translators, what we find is they are absolutely incredible at translating the original language, which would have been Hebrew in this case, into English, but they miss out on what would have described what Esau was feeling just a little bit better. You see, ultimately, when Esau came home, he was hangry, y'all. He was angry because he was so hungry. He had been out all day, hunting all day, walking all day, probably dragging some of his game back home. And he was hangry, y'all. He was so hungry in this moment that he was willing to do anything to quench that appetite, that craving that he had in his life. And ultimately, what takes place next is something that any younger siblings in the room, woo-woo, no younger siblings in the room, just me. Youngest sibling in the room right here, all you younger siblings who weren't willing to say anything or raise their hand, you're going to understand this well. There's something that takes place next that every single one of us younger siblings have reveled in our lives when this takes place with our older siblings. You see, there was a moment in which Jacob began to realize he had been given a moment of upper hand. He now had the upper hand in his relationship with his brother, and he was going to do everything to take advantage of this upper hand that had been granted to him. It's like the moment in your past where your older sibling came home and you were the first one to catch them doing something that you knew and they knew. If mom and dad knew about it, they would be in trouble. You were the first one to see the dent in the bumper of the car. You were the first one to catch them hanging out with the person they shouldn't be hanging out with, smoking their first cigarette. You were the first one to catch them coming back in after curfew. And as you were standing there with your hands on your hip, catching them in the act, what's the first thing that they said to you? Please don't tell dad. Please don't tell mom. And in an instant, as the younger sibling, you knew you had the upper hand. And the question that you asked in the immediate aftermath was something that signified you knew you had the upper hand because you asked this question. What's it worth to you? Let me drive your car? Is it worth the $20 bill in your wallet? Is it worth the Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card? What is it worth to you for me to protect you from getting in trouble in a place in which I understand I now have the leverage and I have the upper hand? And this exact same thing begins to take shape in this story. Check this out. Esau said to Jacob, I'm starved. Give me some of that red stew. What's it worth to you? All right, Jacob replied, but trade me your rights as the firstborn son. Trade me in this moment your birthright. Essentially, what Jacob was saying was this: trade me your future. You have been given a future that is bigger, better, and brighter than mine in the form of this birthright. Trade me that for a bowl of stew. And as we sit here 4,000 years later, y'all, all of us are like, no way! That's the dumbest thing ever. But in this moment, Esau had something in him that every single one of us have experienced in us. Rule your appetite. Or your appetite will rule you. That he had allowed his appetite for more in the moment to block his vision of the better for his future, of the best for his future. That he lost sight of the later and replaced it simply with the now. You see, here is how Esau replied. Look, I'm dying of starvation. I'm dying of starvation. Really, Esau? You are dying of starvation? You see, oftentimes we've experienced this as well. Our appetites lead us to believe things that aren't true. You have to have this to be happy. You have to have more to get where you want to go. That name placard has to be on the door for you to be who you were created to be. Our appetites convince us of things that just downright aren't true. I'm dying of starvation here. And then Esau asks a question that changes everything in his life and has the potential to change everything in ours as well. What good is my birthright to me now? What good is my birthright to me right now? You see, Esau begins to live out what King Solomon wrote about. He begins to live out this practice of being so slouched over that all you can see is me and all you can see is right now. And my birthright really isn't doing anything for me right now. And so it really isn't worth much. And I'm willing to sacrifice that to get what I want when I want it. And I want my appetite quenched right now. Crookedness. Of the treacherous will destroy them. Only seeing right here, right now, only seeing me and not understanding that my decisions have an effect beyond me will ultimately destroy the future that God has designed for us. What Esau failed to understand is that the birthright he had been granted wasn't just a benefit to his future, it was a benefit to his spouse's future. It was a benefit to his kids' future, his grandkids' future. His life and his future and the lives and futures of the people around him would be remarkably different based upon that birthright. And yet he sacrificed it for an appetite right now. It continues on. But Jacob said, first, you must swear that your birthright is mine. So Esau swore an oath, thereby selling all his rights as the firstborn to his brother Jacob. Esau gave up something special later for a simple appetite now. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew. Esau ate the meal, then got up and left. And this is so good, y'all. Esau ate the meal, then he got up and left. The appetite that he was trying to quench right now, what Esau failed to understand is that later always lasts longer. He got up, and what he had traded his future for was gone. He got up and left. Right now is now, but that now is now gone. And that short little bit of now isn't worth sacrificing for the sake of our future, y'all. This is what Esau did. But then to top it all off, he did something that I so often do in the aftermath of following my appetite instead of my integrity. And my hope is that by calling it out, that maybe it'll help me stop doing it. You see, this is ultimately how Esau finished. He showed contempt for his rights as the firstborn. You see, what Esau did is something that I so often do. We act like we don't care when it's too late to care. Essentially, what Esau did from that day for the rest of his life was he continued to have contempt for his birthright by saying things like this: "It really isn't that big of a deal. It isn't that important. I don't care about my birthright. I don't care about my future. It didn't make that big of a difference. It really didn't matter that much in my life. It didn't affect my marriage that much. It didn't affect my parenting that much by what my kids were seeing in that moment. It didn't matter." Yeah, what if it did? What if it mattered a whole lot? What if we could rewind and do it all again? Wouldn't we? See, we lie and justify about what we've sacrificed on the altar of our appetites. But when we lie and justify what has cost us what's most important and what's cost us our designed future, when we lie about those things, it ultimately distorts who we are. Because the truth is, you can't be who you are when you can't be yourself when you're lying to yourself. You can't be yourself when you are lying to yourself. When you sacrifice your future for the now, you sacrifice a part of yourself. Not just for yourself, for the people you care about most, too. Your appetite doesn't just compete with your integrity. It also competes for your future. And let's just be honest. Sacrificing your future for your appetite is never worth it. Sacrificing your future for your appetite is never worth it. You see, what some of y'all may not know is that I've been in ministry. This is all I've done with my adult life. Since I was 22 years old, coming out of college, I went directly into full-time ministry. But in the first 10 years of my ministry, I worked predominantly with students, 6th through 12th graders. And we would say something consistently. In fact, we still say it consistently to them in our environments right here at CORE. Something that's ridiculously similar to something we said at the beginning of this message. You see, if you remember, we said your appetites ultimately determine the quality and direction of your life. But to our students, we communicate something ridiculously similar. You see, all the time we tell them your friends determine the quality and direction of your life. And yet the concepts of these two truths collide with one another. Check this out. You see, when we look close enough at our relationships and our lives, what we will ultimately find is this, is that when it comes to the unhealthy relationships of our lives, oftentimes our unhealthy relationships always have a shelf life. And on average, the shelf life of our unhealthy relationships, you can look back over the course of your life, you may have one outlier or so, but the unhealthy relationships of our life typically last about 2 to 2.5 years. That's how long the unhealthy relationships last. Because here's ultimately what's happening within unhealthy relationships. It's like two parasites who are devouring on one another. Before long, it's just poof, it's gone. Both of them are worthless, and the relationship has disintegrated. And let me just say this for a second. I'm sorry. Give me grace, y'all. 10-second side note. If you find yourself in an unhealthy, toxic relationship, 9 times out of 10, you are the unhealthy to their unhealthy relationship as well. Y'all okay? When you find yourself engaging in an unhealthy relationship, you own half of that unhealthy relationship. Okay, now we can move on. There is this reality that exists, though, within that shelf life of our relationships. That within those relationships, as we find them coming to an end, ultimately what we find ourselves left with in the aftermath of those unhealthy relationships is usually deemed worthless. In fact, what we find ourselves gaining is the opposite of valuable. Because oftentimes in the aftermath of unhealthy relationships, what we find ourselves with are a whole lot of embarrassment and a whole lot of hurt in our lives. And ultimately, in our lives, there are things within those unhealthy relationships that we have sacrificed, that we have given up, that are unretrievable. Now hear me on this. I did not say unforgivable. But there are things that we have given away within those unhealthy relationships that we can't get back again, or that are ridiculously difficult for us to get back again. And you see, when it comes to our appetites and this competition between our appetites and our integrity, the exact same thing is true. Then the moments that we sacrifice our integrity for the sake of our appetites, we are creating, giving away things that are unretrievable, not unforgivable, but the things that we can't get back again in our presence and in our future. And it brings to light this realization again and again and again. Sacrificing our future and what God intended for you and for me, regardless of who you are, God loves you, has something for you, a purpose and a plan for your future. Is fighting for you. He wants something incredible for you. Sacrificing that on the altar of our appetites will never be worth it. When we sacrifice our future for a bowl of stew, we've sacrificed something that isn't worth sacrificing. So last week we asked a difficult question. And this week, it's going to be no different. Because it's a question that I recognize I need to ask of myself so often when the appetites begin to slide in and begin to rule me and take control. A question that I need to ask to protect and guard my integrity. And it's this. What is my bowl of stew? What is my bowl of stew? What is yours? That thing you know you ought to say no to, but it's so ridiculously difficult to say no to. You see, we have no idea what hangs in the balance of our choices of integrity or appetite. Don't trade your future. Don't trade your story. Don't trade your legacy for a bowl of stew. You see, maybe today is a day of declaration for you. Man, your past has looked one way, but there's a way for your future to look completely different from this day forward. And it revolves around this declaration. I will not trade what I value most for the appetite that I have now. I will not trade what I value most for the appetite that I have right now. What would change if daily we were able to wake up and make that declaration in our life over our choices? I will not trade what I value most for the appetite that I have right now. And maybe for some of you, this truth that I want to finish with is the truth that just unlocks something in your story for your future. You see, so often when we get ridiculously honest, when we look close enough, what we'll find is this. Is that almost every single one of the appetites that we have in our lives stems from our desire to be somebody. I just want to be somebody better. Be somebody more. Be somebody different. Be somebody else.
I just want to be somebody. And maybe if I get that, then I can finally become the somebody that I crave to be. And yet there's this one truth that I want you to hear and know and believe. And for some of you, I want to remind you of. And for others of you, I want to speak it into your life for the very first time. You already are somebody. The God of the universe created you, and when he looked at you, he said, "You are my masterpiece." Nothing ever has, nothing ever will change that about you. And yet he didn't just stop at that. He doubled down 2,000 years later when he said, "You are enough of a somebody that I'll send my only son to die a criminal's death for you, for your future, for your eternity." No amount of inclusion, respect, progress, achievement, winning, stuff, more stuff, or new stuff can make you that kind of a somebody. The God of the universe has already made you somebody. Somebody that doesn't need to quench an appetite to be something more. You are somebody. And because you're already somebody, the bowl of stew is not worth it. Not for your future, not for what's most important to you, but also not for the futures of those who are more important to you as well. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you that this one truth can change it all. Our appetite stems from our desire to be somebody. Somebody more, somebody better, somebody different. But you've already made us somebody. You sent your son to die to prove that we were somebody to you. A God who sees us as enough of a somebody that, like we sang this morning, you never stop running after us. You never stop fighting for us. And so God, on this day, may we have the courage to recognize, and we don't have to spend our lives chasing an appetite to be somebody, an appetite, a bowl of stew that can ultimately cost us our future. Because we already are somebody. And we can declare, "I will not sacrifice what's most important to me for an appetite I have right now. Later is always longer." So God, help us to make the courageous choice to ask the difficult question, "What is my bowl of stew?" And when we call out that appetite, push it aside, to recognize that bowl of stew in my life, my marriage, my parenting, my workplace, my finances, my integrity is not worth the sacrifice. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.